So we're going to do this informally, which means that I'm going to introduce Mark, he's going to introduce me, we're going to talk about some of what we like, our favorite Superman secrets, and then we're going to open it up for questions or people to say anything they want. And I had the easiest job of the day, which is to introduce to you the guy to my right. I don't think that anybody in the comic book world really needs an introduction. Mark has actually done more characters, he's written more characters than anybody alive, and he may have done Superman longer than number two or three or one.
I've certainly written more about, if you count not only the stories but also the academic articles and the encyclopedia stuff, and I've written more about Superman than pretty much anybody alive.
So he's been in the business for longer than 25 years, and all of that I've just said is stuff that you could have found on his resume. What you can't find on his resume is what somebody does when they have a know-nothing author like me coming to them and saying, tell me about Superman. And I was writing a biography that is now out called Superman, the High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. And I interviewed probably 250 people, and none of them were more gracious than Mark. None of them knew more than Mark. And absolutely none of them had a better Superman collection than Mark. He has. Do you have every issue back to the beginning?
Yes. Yeah.
Every single issue. So I'm not going to tell you where he lives because
you know I'm not home right now, and you can rent that. That's my big fear at San Diego. Some year somebody's going to go, you know, there's 4 days of the year we know he's not home. Where's the U-Haul rental? Yeah.
So if anybody knows Superman's secrets and things that nobody else knows, it's this guy to my right.
My name is Mark. And likewise, I mean, Larry's being very gracious. He was not a know-nothing author. He called me. We talked about a year ago, a little more than a year ago. And there's been a bunch of people doing Superman books over the years, but Larry seemed to be coming at it from exactly the right point of view. He didn't have an axe to grind. He didn't have a specific agenda. He wasn't focused on one specific aspect of Superman, like the media stuff or the movies. It was just a much more well-rounded biography of the biography sort of the an analysis biography of the character, which is something I've been waiting to read all my life, like one that the perfect well-rounded book. And I'm not just waxing his car. I mean it when I say I've read the book now. I was delighted by it. It hit everything. I may have found like one or two little niggling tiny there, but we'll get to that little tiny thing. But little tiny, super tiny stuff. The big, you know, you get all the facts right. All the pieces are there. And man, I'm really impressed. So Larry Ty, ladies and gentlemen.
So one more waxing kind of comment, and that is, I don't know if you know what it's like in terms of writing books these days, but you never depend on, I happen to have a brilliant editor at Random House, but you never depend on your editor to correct facts or to really have the book shine the way you want it to. So what you do before you send a book in to your real editor, you find expert editors, and then you find expert writers, and you have them look at it and try to save you on errors. And Mark was one of my expert readers, and he saved me. Anything that's wrong in the book, you can blame on me. Anything that was right, he probably put right.
Yeah, you're being kind. I was teasing a second ago. There is, I forget what it is, and I'll email you later. It's like a date that's off by a month or something like that. It's real. If that's the biggest mistake you made in that book, I've seen books about Superman where they misspell Siegel and Schuster, so I really wouldn't worry about it. It's a really nice piece. So thank you for driving, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for driving. We'll be done. We should. How many people have actually seen the book so far? People read it? What do you think? I need an unsolicited opinion from this woman here. Have you read it? What do you think? Whoever raised their hand and said they'd read it. Yes? I thought so.
That's my sister-in-law back there.
And you, sir?
I got it on my iPad.
Yep. I got it on my iPad as I was getting on a plane, and by the time I got off the flight, I'd read it. I mean, I'd read manuscript stuff along the way, but to be able to read it from start to finish. How many people are in here because they're big Superman fans? Oh, I like that. So.
So what are the rest of you doing here?
That's the question. It's like waiting for. Well, let me ask you what. What was it? You were not a lifelong, like, hardcore aficionado exactly. You weren't the kind of like the rest of us geeks who, you know, have our houses filled with Superman memorabilia. What was it that attracted you to the subject matter?
Two things. The serious answer is what attracted me to Superman was I was really intrigued. I had written books before about other kinds of heroes. My last book was on a guy, anybody here ever hear of Satchel Paige? Arguably the best baseball pitcher ever. And I was intrigued by heroes like that. Why we as Americans embrace the heroes that we do. And I thought the best way to look at that was to look at the longest lasting hero in this country in the last 100 years. And my argument is that Superman is that hero. That was a serious reason. The real reason I wrote this book was I wanted to be 10 years old again. And for the last 2 years, I felt like everything I did. If you can imagine spending 2 years and calling it work, reading comic books, watching every old Superman TV show. Right, exactly. We may be the only two guys who can do that. And the idea of calling that work was really fun. And I found a publisher who was willing to take me up on that. But the So I'd love to start for a second here with one of the things. I know much less than Mark about Superman, but start with one of the things that I think no Superman fan, no matter how much of a fan you are, might have known about the Superman story. And I say that because it was in the process of researching a book. If you're an old journalist like me, what you try to do is find material that's never been out there before. And one piece of material that was never seen before by anybody other than, I think, Mark and a few lawyers is the 100-page memoir that was never published that Jerry Siegel left behind. He had this thing, he talked at various times about publishing, and he actually went to some lengths to think about doing it, but it never made it out there. And it has now made it out there as part of a lawsuit that his heirs brought against DC Comics and Time Warner. And it fills in a story of what Jerry was thinking when he first started thinking about Superman. And I'd like to give you the 2-minute version of what Jerry Siegel was like. Jerry Siegel, I think in today's terms, we would call a bullied kid. He was out there every day. He was a little bit too short, he was a little bit too round, and he had glasses that were a little bit too thick to have an easy life when he was a kid going to school. And every day on the playground, kids would come up and tease him, and they would say, "Siegel, Siegel, birds of an eagle." And I don't know quite what that means, but I know that it wasn't something you wanted kids yelling at you on the playground, particularly when the girls were watching. And he would have liked to have flown away from that kind of taunting. And since he couldn't do that, what he did was, at night he would go to bed with a pad of paper and a pencil and dream up another world that would let him fly away. And the first thing that he dreamt up was a character that you may have heard of called The Super-Man. And it was a story that he actually did publish about a guy who wanted to take over the world and had incredible powers. And this is sort of Jerry, the way to fight back against the bullies is to have power and money and anything else you'd want so that the world is yours. This character evolved in a really profound way, I think in part because at about age 17, Jerry had something traumatic happen in his life. And the trauma was that his dad, anybody know what Jerry Siegel's dad did? What did he do?
He was a tailor, was he not? Mm-hmm.
Well, he ran a store, a used clothing store, where he was a bit of a tailor. It was called the Haberdashery, and he did a little bit of everything. He sold the clothes, he would mend the clothes, he would fit the clothes to fit you, and one day, three guys walk into that used clothing store, and they try on a suit, and they walk out with the suit without paying. And Jerry Siegel's father, there are lots of great stories that have grown up around this, none of which are true in terms of his actually being shot and killed. It makes a very dramatic story. But what happened is he had a massive heart attack. And as the police report documents, he was dead before they got him to a hospital. And so you're a 17-year-old kid. You're the youngest of 6 kids, and you suddenly lose your dad. And this puts a big, big vacuum in your life. And so this story of The Super-Man became a little bit different. Jerry dropped the, he dropped the hyphen, and he dropped the bad guy act. And the first version of this story that was ever written and drawn shows a guy who I think it's not a stretch to say looked a lot like Michael Siegel, who was being robbed, and suddenly this character zooms in to save him. And I think this was Jerry trying to do what he wished that he could have done when these guys came into the store and caused Michael Siegel to have a heart attack. And so we've now got the good guy character of Superman, and we've now got a 100-page memoir of Jerry Siegel's telling us just what he was thinking when he wrote that character.
I'm totally with you. I think that I thought I knew everything about the Superman legacy, and when I think it was Gerard Jones in his book Men of Tomorrow, when he was researching it, who found that piece of the puzzle that Elder Siegel had been killed. And that was the click of a puzzle piece falling into place that we never really understood, that anger and vengeance that must have been part of this need for a protective hero that Jerry had burning inside him. I love how much detail and digging you've been doing and so forth. What are the sort of the big wellsprings of resources that have existed for you as far as this book goes?
Great. I'm going to get back to you in a second.
Okay.
I spent 20 years as a journalist, and it's a lot more fun being on the side asking the questions and answering them.
Sorry.
This is great. So the answer is, what you do when you're out there writing a book about a character like Superman that's, by definition, if he lasted 74 years, a lot of people must know a lot about him, and you're trying to find the tiny bit of value added, not just piecing together what people have said before. So I said part of what I had was this memoir of Jerry Siegel's.
Which, by the way, and I say this, you can't say this, I can say this, it reads like a 100-page Larry King column. It's just, you can see the vision of this guy, by the way, lived at the time less than a mile from where I live now. So I know the neighborhood, hunched over this keyboard, and all the rage and all the anger, he wrote it in 75, 76,
yes.
All this anger and all this rage, all this I didn't get Superman, I got Superman stolen away from me, all of it's in every keystroke, and the pages are almost glowing with heat and anger and rage, and therefore it's not structured, it's not a good read. Because really, it's more like and again, I don't mean this to sound unkind, it's like a screed. It's like a keening, a wailing on paper about all this injustice that had been done to him, peppered with anecdotes and facts that are fascinating. But really, it's raw. It's really an interesting read. And I think now you can find it. I think Danny Boy online, if you do a research online, I think the Danny Boy site has that online now. So.
Yes, I would add one more adjective to what Jerry's memoir is. To me, as a longtime medical journalist, it read like I was reading somebody's psychiatric notes, that these are the things that he was pouring out to his therapist, because on the one hand, he was really, really, really angry at DC Comics, and on the other hand, he said 10 times in there, I'm not going to tell you how angry I am at DC Comics.
Yeah.
And he was going back and forth. And so the other thing that was out there, in wonderful, rich detail as part of this lawsuit, as part of things that were discovered as part of this lawsuit, was a like 30 or 40-year correspondence between Jerry Siegel and his chief antagonist at DC Comics. You'll remember the founders of DC Comics, the founders is probably the wrong word, the two guys who ran DC Comics
right.
at the beginning, who may have taken it over from Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson, who was the founder.
The crooks who stole it from
the
Major Malcolm. You can't say that.
Yes,
I can
exactly.
say that. So.
The pornographers who stole it from the... These guys, Harry Donenfeld and Jack Liebowitz, were Jerry and Joe's chief antagonists, and particularly Jerry's. And there are 30 years of correspondence between Jerry and Jack that read like a father writing to his son, that Jerry wanted more than anything in the world, I'm convinced, to have Jack accept him. Jack was an older guy. He thought Jack would take care of him, and he wanted Jack to accept him. That is half of his writing to him. Jerry also, a very painful thing happened to Jerry after he had his first child, which is his wife delivered a second baby that died during childbirth. And the first guy that he wrote anything to about this was Jack Liebowitz, this guy he was having this battle with over 30 years. And yet Jack's notes back to Jerry, in somewhat similar fashion, read at times like he was writing to his son and at times like he was writing to the most spoiled guy in the world. Jerry thought that Jack had ripped him off for this grand total of $130 that he had to share with Joe of his prized possession. Jack thought that Jerry had been taken out of obscurity, finally found a publisher after 5 years of searching for it, and was incredibly ungrateful in the first 10 years that Jerry and Joe were writing Superman. Anybody have any idea how much money they made?
Guess. Throw out some numbers.
$500 million.
Very nice. That's what they thought they should have made. Say it again.
$500.
So one would have assumed from any of the stories that you've read about Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, they had made relatively little money, that they had been had their property stolen from them for $130. When you look in today's dollars at what they made, it is $5 million in today's terms. In those terms, it made them quite rich. It took them out of obscurity and made them famous. They were the subject of profiles in the leading publications in America, and they were making enough money that they could own property in New York, come back to Cleveland, their hometown, and own a great house. And when you look at all of this is now out there as part of the public file, and it gives a different insight into these guys. Nobody's saying that they weren't ripped off, but the story was much more quid pro quo than we've ever seen it out there.
This is one of the reasons I'm glad that Larry's book exists. I've been involved in the Siegel and Shuster lawsuit for about 8 or 9 years now, in terms of Warner dealing with the Siegel heirs. And they called a little while ago. They called years ago. They said, Warner did. They said, listen, we want you to testify as an expert witness for Warner Brothers. And my first thought was, oh, wow, I don't want to side with the man. I don't want to be the guy telling Siegel and Shuster they shouldn't get the money. They said, no. You don't understand. There's a lot more to the story than you think. And as the historical curiosity just got to me, and I sort of dipped my toe in it, I always said that I would never say or write about anything about Superman that I didn't feel from the heart, or about Siegel and Shuster that I didn't feel from the heart. And it wasn't an issue. But boy, one of the things that did kind of break my heart, not because I have any special love for DC Comics, not because I have any sort of axe to grind with anybody, but just because I believe in fairness. I believe in fairness and disclosure. Finding out the reality of not only how much money really had been generated by Siegel and Shuster and how much they had gotten, not a fair share, but not a pauper share either. And I wasn't in a position, I wasn't in a position where I could talk about it, and nobody else sort of knew this stuff. And it would just grate at me when I would hear people talk about how, $130 and they died poor and stuff. And I think, but there's more to the story. That's not, again, like I said, I'm not trying to take Warner Brothers' side at all. I'm just saying that feels good. I also know how much in the last 10 years Warner Brothers has made offers over and over and over again that I, without throwing out numbers to you, I guarantee you are eminently fair to the Siegel family. Paul Levitz, before he retired as publisher, was the ombudsman for DC Comics as far as the Siegels go and the Shusters go. And Paul, and I don't always see eye to eye on stuff, but Paul fought the good fight since 1976 as part of that team that got Siegel and Shuster their names back on that property to make sure that the monies and the compensation that they were getting in their later years was as fair as possible. And I've looked at the numbers, and I'm telling you, pretty fair numbers. The biggest problem that I think is holding up the suit as it is that the Siegel's lawyer is redacted. Let's just say redacted. Siegel-Shuster, the Siegel's lawyer, in my opinion, may not be acting in their best interest. That alone can probably get me sued. But I'll stop there. But what I'm glad about is that Larry, as part of Larry's book, we're able to get some of that truth out there, which I like. I just think that sunlight's the best disinfectant on all this stuff. And I just like there being all the facts out there. I'll stop. I sound like I'm shilling for Warner Brothers now. I'll stop. But there you go.
So when you think of Superman. This is an audience of people who probably know Superman down five levels deep. Yeah. What are some of the most fun things that you know that nobody else in the world knows?
Nobody else in the world knows besides his social security number. So, 09209-6616. Don't they teach you anything in school? My God. Or his telephone number, 555-10162. But it's more to me, the fun things that I've learned about Superman over the years are less about the character himself, because all that stuff is in the pages. All that stuff's on the printed page. Some of it's not. You know, actually, I'll tell you what, here's one of the things I found that, we've told the story a little bit before, but let me go into a little detail. How many people know an old book called The Steranko History of Comics? It's a big tabloid-sized history of comics. It was done in the early 70s. So Jim Steranko, who was an artist and publisher, did a chapter on Superman. And in it, there are four pages that reproduced, I'm not any bigger than that, from an unpublished Superman story. And even as a kid, that lit me up. If you say the magic word unpublished Superman story, I'm all over it, because I am, with the exception of the radio shows that nobody can find anymore because they don't exist, I'm the only guy in the world who's read every story, who's listened to every radio play, who's the every short story, every novelization, every Superman story is in here somewhere. I've read it. It's unpublished. Oh my God. So I've been hunting for this story for years because apparently it had something to do with kryptonite, but that didn't make any sense. This story said 1943, but kryptonite didn't appear until 1949. I'm so confused. So, cut to years later, and I was an editor at DC Comics. This is 87, I guess. And it is the Wednesday before Thanksgiving break, and everybody's sort of letting out early. And I don't have any family coming into town. I'm just going to sit and eat a cold turkey sandwich in my overpriced New York apartment. So I hang around the office a little late, and I'm poking around the library, and it's kind of disheveled, and I'm looking at cool stuff, the kind of thing that only I know what that is. Oh, that's an unpublished cover from Challenger of the Unknown, or oh, that's this. And I get the sheaf of, it's like this box with a ream of papers in it, and I pull it out, and it's all these carbon copies, like old carbon copies, blue carbon, not even black carbon, but that sort of crappy blue carbon they used to use. Let me explain to anybody who's under 35 what a carbon copy is. In other words, you would in a typewriter, you would have, I know, and he doesn't, you really don't know. I'm explaining. It's going to go. You understand? You're familiar with typewriters as a concept. That's good. You put in your piece of manuscript paper, and then behind it you put a piece of special thin paper that has carbon backing, and then you put another white piece of paper behind that for the sandwich. Like you sandwich a piece of carbon paper behind it, so as you type, it leaves an imprint on the back page. So you're making a carbon copy as you print. You're typing two copies at once. I can't believe I just had to explain carbon paper. Going to 80. I'm going to hit you in my walker. So there's all these carbon copies, and I don't even know what I'm looking at, because the format of comic scripts, especially in the 1930s and 40s, was not terribly formal. It's just these single spaced manuscripts, and I pull one up, and it's a Superman script, and I thought, well, that's interesting. That actually seems familiar to me. Like that's from Superman number 6. I kind of remember that because I don't know who my presidents are. I can't name but 25 states, but I can tell you everything about the Kryptonian Science Council. So I'm going through these and thinking, you know what? I want to go pair these up with the existing stories. So I'm in the DC Library, which to me is the Ark of the Covenant and the whole, Library of Alexandria all rolled into one. And I'm going through pairing the scripts up to stories. They don't have titles. In the Golden Age, the stories didn't have titles, so it was harder. I would have to read a few pages of each story and the scripts and stuff. And when I got to the bottom of the box, there was one story that I couldn't pair up anywhere, and I'd never seen it before, and I'd never read it before. There were two things about it that were really interesting. One was that all Superman stories from the Golden Age period were 13 pages long, all of them. That was the format. This one, oddly enough, was 26 pages long. So automatically we've got a rarity. And I start flipping through it, and I realize this is where those unpublished pages that Steranko had found must have come from. It's a story about this weird thing called K-Metal, which came from Superman's home planet of Krypton and made him weak, like kryptonite later would. So it's the untold origin of kryptonite, and as I read the story, that is not even remotely the most interesting thing about it. It is 26 pages long, and it is a story in which Superman loses his powers for the first time because of K-metal. There's a meteor coming to Earth, and people are mining it. And again, it's explained very much the way they would explain kryptonite later. It's a fragment from your home world, and the radiation gives off something that makes Superman weak. But at the end of the story, and this is the part that's mind-blowing, at the end of the story, Superman and Clark and Lois are trapped in an abandoned mine with some criminals. They're going to die unless Clark changes to Superman to do something to let them out. They're going to die of oxygen deprivation. So Clark Kent takes off his suit and becomes Superman right there in front of Lois, and Lois is gobsmacked by this. Oh my God, it's true. You really are Superman. He says, yes, I'm Superman. He goes out, saves everybody, and there is no super magic kiss like at the end of Superman 2 that blanks her memory out. There is no, it was a dream. There is no hoax. At the end of the story, the epilogue is Lois and Clark are now partners in crime solving, if you will. Lois now knows the secret, and now she's going to do everything she can to help Clark make his changes and excuses when he needs to go off and be Superman. And that was going to be the status quo of the strip. This was written 2 years after Superman premiered. In newspaper strips of the time, you had character progression like that. Not often, but I think Gasoline Alley was really the first one. Let me explain to you what Gasoline Alley is. Was the first comic strip that actually had characters aging and progressing in real time. Well, so it only makes sense if you're Siegel. You don't know that Superman's going to last for 75 years. You're just kind of writing to make the characters grow and change. So, but at the end of that story, the status quo, the irrevocable status quo, was going to be Lois knows Clark's secret, and the two of them are going to be, again, partners in this. And by the way, there's something out there that's a lot like kryptonite. Well, the publishers came down the hall, and as near as anybody can reconstruct the story, because nobody's alive that really knows for sure, but the best guess is somebody looked at it, Donenfeld or Leibowitz, and said, no, you can't do this. We have a good thing going. We have a radio show that's just launched. We have a newspaper strip that's just launched. We can't let you so fundamentally change the tenets of this character, the tenets of the myth so early on. You're going to have to back burner this. So the entire story was drawn. We've seen many of the pages still exist, but it was never used. And that's, I love the fact that I live in a world where Superman did this, but in some alternate universe somewhere that story got printed about the time of Superman 6 or Superman 7, and think about it, the entire Superman mythos from that point would have been radically different.
It's extraordinary. And they actually came up with ads?
And they actually,
the crypto ray gun?
They actually did. They came up with ads for something called the crypto ray gun, which was powered by a mysterious thing called kryptonite, which allowed Superman to show film strips on the... I don't know why you need a radioactive mineral from another world to show film strips on your wall, but that was the first use of the word kryptonite, was as a film capturing thing. I didn't make a lot of sense, trust me. But that's one of my favorite Superman...
That's
secrets. I promise that the rest of them will not take 20 minutes to tell like that one did.
So before we turn it over to hear questions and stories that you might have, let's take it a little bit into other media.
Yeah.
And my favorite was, everybody, I'm convinced, after interviewing hundreds of fans around the world, that everybody fell in love with the first Superman that they encountered. And that's the one they always think about. And for me, if I close my eyes and I'm trying to envision Superman, the guy that I see there is George Reeves. And from the TV Adventures of Superman, when there was something called black and white TV back in the 1950s. And one of the things that I felt like I had to do was figure out that there are almost as many stories out there, conspiracy theories out there about what happened to George Reeves as there are about JFK or Robert Kennedy. And I spent a long time, when I was out seeing Mark, I was also in LA out seeing the current county coroner and looking at every expert record ever done on what happened to George Reeves. And if you don't remember, there were in 1959, I can't remember what month and what day, there was a shocking headline that appeared in every newspaper across America saying that Superman had killed himself. And that was not only unlikely, to every kid in America that was physically impossible, that even if Superman had wanted to, he couldn't kill himself. Nobody could kill Superman. And so it was shocking. And it was the same way a lot of people today remember who were in that era, the day and what they were doing the day that John Kennedy was shot. People remembered what they were doing the day that George Reeves was shot. And so I wanted to see, did he really kill himself? There have been movies, Hollywoodland, done with three different endings and books written about it. And I spent all this time and I came away with, it would have been much more dramatic for my book if I could have come away and said, his girlfriend, whose husband was mobbed up, had come in and wiped him out, and here's how he did it. What I think killed George Reeves, and it's a really sad story, is I think he was taking painkillers because he had been in a couple car accidents not long before he died. He was drinking too much, which is not a great thing to mix with painkillers that he was taking. And he was partly depressed, not as depressed as it's been made out over the years, but depressed about the fact that he had started out as an actor imagining himself being big in the movies. And he was one of the twins in the Gone with the Wind movie. If you remember the Tarleton twins, he was one of them. And he had all these visions of doing great things. And not only was he stereotyped as Superman, but back then, TV was death to a career if you wanted to be in Hollywood. And so I think he combined those three things. He happened to keep a gun next to him in his dressing table, the German Luger. And I think one night, he took out the gun, and he did just what the coroner said. They did one of the shoddiest investigations ever, but when forensic scientists, using today's standards, go back and look at all the evidence was there, the conclusion was he shot himself, and he shot himself because drugs, drink, and depression had made him really vulnerable that night. Anything from the TV series?
Thanks for bringing down the room, Larry.
Seriously.
No, it's the biggest contribution. I was actually never a fan of the TV show, and that is because when I was a kid, I lived in the rural South, and there was very little syndicated television show there. So, because by the time I was growing up, it was the late '60s, early '70s. So that, you know, we wouldn't have been seeing first run Superman stuff. I didn't see first run George Reeves shows until after the movie came out. And I was already a late teenager, and I was thinking, this is awesome, but where's Lex Luthor? Where's the Bottle City of Kandor? Where's Crypto? Where's the Fortress of Solitude? This doesn't feel like Superman to me. It's a bunch of guys in gray suits walking around an office. But I don't denigrate it. I've watched the shows, and one of my favorite things about it is that one of the things that it did was it made a star out of Jimmy Olsen. That was the big takeaway from the show. Superman... DC had launched very few brand new characters in their own series in the 40s and 50s, and comics were sort of on the wane. But Jimmy was always a big part of the radio show. It's in fact invented by the radio show, and or at least popularized by the radio show. But his portrayal on the television show is what landed him his own comic that ended up lasting 163 issues, many of them good. Many of them readable. No, they're all good. I was 11. There's no such thing as a bad comic when you're 11. My memory, like, what got me in, and I promise I'll keep it short. I've told this story a little bit before. When I was 14, 15, I had left home. I had kind of a rough childhood. And I'm not looking for sympathy. I'm just saying I didn't have any strong parental figures. And I went to see Superman the movie. Now, I liked Superman at that point, but I also liked Batman and Captain America, and I like comics, and that's one of the many things in the world I like. So I went in to see the movie, and I saw it twice. I saw it twice in a row, just sitting there, just mesmerized. And I walked out of that movie, still not knowing what direction my life was going to take, because I was, I'll be blunt with you, I was a fairly semi-suicidal kid with no hope and no ambition and no direction and, like I said, no strong parental figures. And I came out of that movie knowing that no matter what the rest of my life was going to be, it was somehow going to involve Superman. And it took me a long, long time to put my finger on exactly what that was that turned me around in that 4 hours in a movie theater. But it was, you look back at Christopher Reeve's portrayal in particular, and I went in there as a kid who felt like nobody cared about him. And Christopher Reeve, Superman in particular, makes it abundantly clear. Superman cares about everybody. Whether you're rich or you're poor, whether you're black or you're white, whether you're young or you're old, he cares about everybody. And I know that sounds a little goofy and cornball coming from a man of my age, but when I was a teenager, I needed that emotional lifeline, and that is, as much as anything, what has made me a lifelong, not only fan, but defender of Superman. So don't say anything bad about him, or else there'll be trouble.
So one of the things that I talk about in the book is what religion Superman is.
Right.
What's your take on it?
My take is I assume he would have been brought up probably Methodist, maybe Presbyterian, but probably Methodist, just because of the locale of where he landed, which, depending upon where you look, was either Kansas, which actually he never landed in Kansas until the movies. That was the first place that it was actually established. In fact, Smallville before then was described as just outside Metropolis, which seems unlikely, as all the farmers outside Manhattan would tell you. And in the radio show, it was established as in Illinois or Indiana. I forget which of the two. Is it Indiana? Do you know?
I think it's Indiana.
But other than that, it's always been just on the outskirts of Metropolis, and Metropolis must be New York. But given that he grew up in the farmlands, I would have always assumed he would have been raised Methodist. But your thoughts?
My thoughts are that everybody wants to embrace Superman. Christians see him as the consummate Christ story. God sends his son to earth and is going to make mankind better than it was. Buddhists see him as a perfect Zen-like character. Who could be more Zen than Superman? Atheists and agnostics say he's a secular messiah. He's got no religion. I argue in my book that Superman is Jewish. And my evidence, I think that Jerry and Joe were playing a game with us and that they were having fun. And they send this character from Krypton with a name like Kal-El, which sounds sort of exotic, but in fact it's not picked randomly. Anybody who speaks Hebrew would know that Kal-El means El is God and Kal is a voice or vessel. And he was sending him down as a voice or vessel of God. That the story of parents trying to save their only son by floating him out into not a river, but into the atmosphere, and he's adopted in the middle of Indiana or Kansas or wherever it is, by two who could be more Gentile than John and Martha Kent. And I think that's a story straight out of Exodus and Moses. But to me, the most compelling piece of evidence, I go through 20 pieces of evidence. The most compelling is any name that ends in M-A-N is either a superhero or a Jew, or in Superman's case, both.
Yeah.
So can we, I see a 15-minute sign there. Can we, is that mic activated? And anybody who has a question or a secret or anything that you want to do, stand up there.
I have questions for Mark. Did DC really have plans to kill off Superman in the original Crisis, as far as you know, which Superman?
No, actually, they didn't. The plan with the original Crisis was not to kill off the original Superman. The plan to kill off Superman was an emergency stopgap that was thrown out when they were planning on the marriage of Lois and Clark to tie in with a TV show of the time, and then at the last second, the producers of the Lois and Clark TV show said, you know, we're going to put that off for a couple of seasons, and DC suddenly felt like, oh God, we got to do something big. And then Jerry Ordway, who was the artist and writer at the time, threw out, as he always does in those rooms, I've been there, and he says, just kill him off. And this time it took. So, by the way, spoiler, he's not really dead. So. They must have. I'm sure if you go down to graffiti booth downstairs, if they haven't already made one, I'm sure they must have one in their back catalog. Yeah.
Okay.
And the new one, actually, the movie, the movie next year, that S looks very much like the Golden Age.
Oh, yeah.
Superman S.
Hi. Congratulations, Mark.
Thank you.
Your eyes are,
thank you.
The only comic book we should be reading is all stuff by you, I guess.
Thank you. Next question, please. Stop now.
I am married into comics, mm-hmm. So I came late to the game.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching. So you're.
I'm good with that. Thank you. Thank
you. So my question is for you, and it's kind of out of your redeeming one. I thought about it a lot. You may have answered it somewhere else, but I don't know the answer, so yeah. I'm asking you a question.
That's what I'm here for.
What was your inspiration for Irredeemable? Was it your love of Superman and just an anger you had with what was going on, or twisting the story somehow?
A big part of my inspiration, for those of you who don't know, Irredeemable is a story I did about 37 issues of for Boom Studios, which was the basic concept, and it got away from this pretty quickly, was what happens in a world where Superman snaps, where Superman just goes insane, and now all his friends are trying to calm him down, and he's taking over the world, and bad things are happening. I created a character named the Plutonian. Really where it came from was I had thought for a while about the origin of Superman, and the classic origin of the star child coming in the ship and passing by a lonely couple longing for a child. And the scientist in me, the physics major in me, as a college physics major, has always been interesting, thinking about the powers, thinking about how the powers must work on some sort of quantum level. And one night I just kind of got in my head just thinking about how maybe, and I was just goofing around, you know, because you can't really do this with a Superman origin, because it's too entrenched, and I'm not even sure you'd want to do this with a Superman origin, because it makes him too inhuman. But I thought, you know, is it possible that Kal-El in that rocket was not really a humanoid baby? That he was more like a golem, if you will, a golem, rather. He was more like a clay creature that is that would be imprinted by the worship and the, you know, the love of those, the beliefs of those around him, if that makes sense. And I thought about that. Yeah, and he exists because people need to believe in a character like that. That stuck with me, and then when I came to me, the final piece that was, and in that moment, as he's flying over the Kansas fields, you know, the one thing that Golem would feel more strongly than anything else is a woman wishing upon a star that she had a child. And that just, I said, I can't ever do that with Superman, but I can do that with Plutonian, I can do that with my own character. And the difference then becomes Ma Kent is a tremendously supportive and loving and wonderful mother. What happens when that happens to that you know, a set of circumstances happens to a child by a mother with mental illness? And what imprint does that put on that character? What happens to Superman if he never had a chance? If he was never brought up by people who knew how to do it?
Thanks.
My pleasure. I'm again bringing down the room. ask me his favorite hobby. Go ahead. He collects clocks.
I'm working on catching up to you, trying to read through everything, but it's going to take a while. Yeah. And I haven't read this book yet because I was prepping for this con. But Superman Birthright is my favorite of the origins.
Thank you. Oh, that's good. I mean, sadly, Lois has not had a lot of really good moments over the years, because her trajectory was charted by Mort Weisinger, really. He's the one who turned that, because the TV show made Lois popular enough to sustain her own book as well. And Mort Weisinger was the editor of the Superman books from the mid-50s to the late 1960s. He was an imaginative man. He and his writers created this entire mythos that surrounded Superman, from Krypton to the Bottle City of Kandor to the Pets to Supergirl, all that stuff. He was also a tyrannical crackpot, who was just a bizarre, toad-like man who was angry, and I defy you to find anyone in all of comics. I've never met him. I defy you to find anybody in all of comics history who has anything good to say about Mort Weisinger. His best friend was Julie Schwartz, his editor who he shared an office with. They knew each other back in the science fiction days. His best friend at Mort's funeral, the eulogy was, Julie got up and said, his brother was worse. That is, my hand to God, is a true story. Mort had certain beliefs, certain psychological eccentricities that manifested in these books. He had a very strong feeling, clearly, about a woman's place in the world, and in you know, it really was all about Lois wanting to be married, wanting to be taken care of, wanting to be attractive and young. If you look at all those Mort Weisinger stories, the two worst things you can be in a Mort Weisinger story are fat and bald, both of which Mort was. This is true over and over. All those stories, like, oh my God, Superman's turned fat, and it's being just the worst thing in the world. In that sense, Moore just had a really retrogressive idea about what women's liberation was all about and what the power of women in society was. And I think Lois took the brunt of that for a long time. She was great in the 40s and 50s. She was Torchy Blaine. She was the kick-ass, you know, take no guff female reporter. That's the one I like. And I didn't find her again until Elliot Maggin came along and did a couple of novels. One was called Last Son of Krypton, and the other one was called Miracle Monday. They were both written in the 70s, and they're Superman novels, and they are as much responsible for defining Superman to me as anything else I've ever read. And man, I loved Elliot's Lois, because she was just take charge. I'm doing all the talking, and I apologize.
No, you're doing wonderful talking. I want to tell a really quick Lois Lane story, which is my book was released a month ago, and the official launch of the book happened at, has anybody here ever been to the annual Metropolis Superman Festival? Well, I didn't know before this that there was a Metropolis, and Metropolis required from Boston, it's a place that you take a plane to Chicago, and then you take one of two planes a day to Paducah, Kentucky, and then you hope that in Paducah there's somebody who will drive you across the Ohio River to Metropolis, because there are no cars to rent and no taxis. And I end up at this festival, 30,000 people come in. Are there taxis there? You find?
I was going to say, why did drivers fly in the St. Louis and just drive
there? Driving, okay. Well, I end up in Metropolis where 30,000 people come, and they build, one of the things they build this year was the festival, the first biography of Superman was going to be released there, and I'm in an auditorium this size, and it's one-third filled, and we're doing a panel, me and Gerard Christopher, who played Superboy, and other people from Superman's past, and there's interest, but not a whole lot of interest, and suddenly in walks a guy with an ancient woman on his arm. And this woman with gray hair has just moved to Metropolis, and she is named Noelle Neal. The original movie serials, Lois Lane, and TV for all but 1 year of that Adventures of Superman. Well, so within about 30 seconds, and that may be too long, between text messages and cell phones, that auditorium was standing room only. Yeah. And she to me still represents Lois Lane at her best, an incredibly feisty woman who, even after hip surgery and being 92, I think, today, is out there talking about what Lois Lane meant, that when she played this character, she had more women come up to her over the years and say, this was the only role model for a feisty, professional woman who showed Clark Kent what a good journalist was supposed to be like, and she embodied it. And she's still at age 92, can draw a hell of a crowd.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the Christopher Reeve's presentation of Superman before, and I really love that as well. I love those movies. But something that's always kind of been on my mind about those movies are some of the liberties they took with his superpowers. Like when he threw a gigantic S off his chest, and he shot a white beam out of his finger at one point.
Yep.
And have you seen much more of that within the other Superman stories?
It's in the first few years of Superman, they were still trying to refine what his powers were. My favorite obscure Superman power for the first few years is that he could change his features like Play-Doh and change his... Which, if you're going to do that, what's the deal with this then? Somebody came to... You know, and there were points at which he could split himself into two halves at some point. They winnowed the powers down pretty quickly. The newspaper strip is where you see some weird uses of his superpowers. I'm the only person that I know of who's got the complete run of the daily strips, and I know I'm the only person in the world with a complete run of the Sunday strips.
But so DC Comics, when they were doing all the Christopher Reeve movies and when they were doing the Brandon Routh Return of Superman, DC Comics was on the set and had the power not just to approve or disapprove the scripts, but anything that went on in the filming. Do they have that same power now with Man of Steel and the movie they're making now?
I don't think they have that same level of power. They would like to. I don't know if they do. I think a lot of that was Paul Levitz, just sort of like getting himself in there and making sure. But yeah, Brick Vision. My favorite was Brick Vision. My favorite was rebuilding the wall of China with Brick Vision. Yes.
When I was a kid, from like 1958 to 1966, Superman was my favorite comic book. He had every superpower: Aquaman, Batman, Flash. They only had one, but he had it all. I was wondering, in any of the stories, are there Jewish themes of the Jewish stories, the Jewish culture, anything that, you said, based on what you said?
So I think that Jerry Siegel was not confident enough to make a character who was explicitly Jewish. Who knew if that could sell? But in his next big try at a comic book success, which was called Funny Man, he had a character who looked like, I don't know if anybody here is old enough to remember Danny Kaye the comedian. Superman, his...
You lie. Yes, look at this. The kid who didn't know what carbon paper is knows who Danny Kaye is. Yay.
So his hero in this Funny Man comic book was explicitly Jewish, and I think that Jerry, after years of just being able to tease out things, Jerry wrote in his memoir one of the most profound lines to me, and it's what every writer is supposed to do. He said, "I wrote what I knew." And what he knew was he grew up in a part of Cleveland, Ohio that was 95% Jewish, and that was a world he knew, and I think that's the world he was writing about. Can I say, they're going to come and bring the cane in a minute. After 74 years, my book was trying to understand why he was a success for this long, but also whether he had a future. And I think there's only one thing that could ever kill Superman, and it's not kryptonite. And I wonder if Mark agrees with this. I think the thing that could kill him is, ironically, a lawsuit brought by the heirs. Yeah. And if they can't agree, if the heirs and the owners can't agree on what's going on, what they're starting to do in the court in Riverside, California, is divide up different pieces and say the cape maybe belonged there from the beginning, so the heirs get that. But the power to fly came when he was clearly our employee. And so the owners get that. And I think what we need, and this is a pitch to the lawyers and to the judge and to everybody, we need somebody as a judge to have the wisdom of Solomon to realize if you rip the baby in half, you don't have a baby left.
Exactly. That's true. Very true. There was, we'll catch you out in the hall because there actually was one. And for, if you'll forgive us, well, go ahead. You got a quick question.
The last one there. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, I was going to ask a little Pookie.
Sure.
Do you like Superman better with the underwear or the trunks?
Right, with the underwear. The underwear, the trunks. Come on, that's what he looks like. It's just, it's Kryptonian styling. It's not that he's too stupid to wear his underwear outside his pants. One last question. Do you have a favorite Superman story?
My favorite Superman story is the when they first had him marry Lois Lane. I love the idea, first of all, that during Mort Weisinger's entire era, they called the stories that he was inventing imaginary stories, sort of to be distinguished from I'm not sure quite what in terms of what everything else was. But I love the idea. It probably wasn't the first marriage story, but the one with the cover that showed Superman flying off to work and Lois staying at home and taking care of things. And it was basically, it was called Mr. and Mrs.
Super, yes, Clark Kent. Superman Kent, yeah.
But we also never knew, I like that in part because we never knew who wrote that, whether right. Jerry wrote it or who.
Right.
Tell us your favorite Superman.
I gotta say, my and this defines Superman for me. There is a story, this is gonna sound like the dumbest thing in the world. Give me 30 seconds, I swear. But follow me to the end. There's a Superman story called Superman Owes $1 Billion. And it's told a couple of times, but it was told in the 60s when I read it. And the idea is that some earnest IRS agent comes in his boss's office and says, here's the thing. I mean, we all love Superman, but he makes all this money for charity. He makes all this money for donations and so forth. That's still taxable income. And he's never filed a tax return. By the letter of the law, Superman owes $1 billion to the United States in taxes. And his boss says, just go deal with it. I don't want to deal with it. So the guy tracks Superman down and Superman is worried. Now Superman's sweating. It's like, oh my God, by the letter of the law, I owe $1 billion in back taxes. So he spends the entire story trying to make things. He tries finding radium that can be, you know, sold, but then a hospital needs it, you know, or doing something else to save it, and then it's all, you know, it's gonna save the world, and then, no, we need this over here for, anyway, you can't come up with $1 billion.
Check out that story. If you, there are exactly one dozen of the books, The History of Superman, left, which are now going because it's the last day for half price. If anybody wants to come down, 15 downstairs. Thank you, it's been a great audience.